The following podcast is not relating to my teachings and work at Del Cid Medical Center and is for entertainment purposes only.
Welcome, everybody. Here is another show of the Life of Flow podcast, the best and most famous podcast in healthcare. Today, we're going to be speaking to two great guests. They are essentially part of the leadership of a company by the name of R3, Wound Care and Hyperbarics. Company that has most of its locations in the DFW area, but has also a location in San Antonio and two in Houston. I had the chance to meet them not too long ago, and I thought they were great people that could share some insights into the show. Elliot Scringer, he is the current acting CEO of the company with 20 plus experience in healthcare leadership, and Dr. Shishir Shah, who is the chief medical officer based out of the Arizona area. Huge, very interesting backgrounds. We'll go more into detail during our conversation, but I thought this was a really cool, just optics on this particular topic that we've been talking a lot about in the pod.
Yeah, it was super insightful and I learned a lot. All these episodes made me kind of realize how little I know about the business,
about the business that we're in.
Daunting, yeah. But it's little by little I start like catching terms. So it was great. I hope you guys enjoy it.
Let's go. Thank you.
Two vascular surgeons walk into a bar and come out with a podcast. We are talking everything vascular and not. Welcome to the Life of Flow podcast.
All right, everyone, welcome to another episode of the Life of Flow podcast. Today we have a great episode. We'll be talking about wound care and hyperbarics in the context of limb salvage with two experts. So we have Dr. Shah joining us today and Elliot, and they will help us understand a little bit about how they incorporate themselves into this problem of limb salvage through their company. And how they're helping tackle and help patients with hyperbarics and wound care. So, Dr. Shah, thank you for being here. Elliot, thank you for being here.
Very exciting to be here. Thank you, gentlemen.
Thanks, guys. First off, we appreciate you being, in a way, our test buddies here. We usually record out of our studio in Austin. And so today we've relocated our studio and attempted to do a lot of it ourselves.
Yeah.
So I do appreciate your patience in getting this and setting it up with us and helping us maneuver this. Lucas, I got the opportunity to meet them not too long ago, and it was a little bit of a serendipitous connection. We hired here at Hope a business development person.
Mm-hmm.
And so she hit the street real fast.
Yeah.
And so yeah. Our business development specialist came to us saying there was this facility close by that was providing advanced wound care and hyperbarics. And I was naturally very tickled by that. That led to a conversation where me and Elliot had breakfast. Actually at the same spot you and I had breakfast this morning. Cool. And that conversation was great. And what was great about it is, and I'm not trying to be petulant, but a lot of the conversations you have in this business are not intellectually enticing.
You know,
they're just meh. You know, you meet a lot of people and some of these conversations can just be, wow, that was a waste of my time, right?
Yeah.
And then some don't. And Elliot was a very intriguing guy. I'll articulate it in the best way I can, which is he didn't seem pompous, but he seemed knowledgeable.
Yeah.
And we seem to be at the same level, right? That we were kind of sharing this vision of wound care overall and what needs to happen in the current state of healthcare for the management of chronic long-term care and how vertical and horizontal integration. And we've had these topics many times in the Life of Flow podcast. Well, anyway, I think Elliot felt a little bit the same. And Elliot, I'm inserting myself into it. Elliot thought I was like super cool.
I'm sure that's what he said. Yeah, I'm a super cool guy.
Elliot was like, "Wow, I've never met a doctor this cool." And so, I'm giving this long-winded intro to this because I think it just puts a little color as to why we're here, why we invited them to talk, and it helps Lucas also level set. But no, in all seriousness, he said, "You know what? You need to talk to Dr. Shaw."
Yeah,
And then, you know, fast forward, we had a meeting with Dr. Shaw and he did his own little intro and I was really blown away.
Oh yeah.
Yeah. And I know, and you know, Lucas was saying that we do our intros off the top. And we do like off camera, we'll record a brief intro, but I'm talking about a 10-second intro, what company you guys work with and who you are. And then we go into the show, but we don't really give these kind of we don't have the capacity to go in depth. And I would love to have both of you, because I think it'll give us a lot of meat on the bone to keep the conversation going, about your backgrounds, about how you got together, build up a little bit on where the company came from, where it's going. And organically, I think that we can bring up a lot of really cool topics that we will all find very, very engaging. And so I'll do it in order of you know, who I met first. But Elliot, do you want to talk to us a little bit about yourself, your background? You're obviously the business head of this very interesting project. Tell us a little bit about the project, about you. And then we'll kick it off to Dr. Shaw, learn a little bit more about his background.
Sounds good. I appreciate the opportunity, guys. And that was a very flattering intro there, Dr. Montero. So thank you for that. But I guess what you're really saying is let's just kind of rehash what we talked about over breakfast, right?
Yes.
Because I think that's really where we started. And it won't be hard to do because for both of us, I think it was pretty organic and it's who we are. So, during that conversation, he actually started Dr. Montero, and I was impressed likewise. And we're not just patting each other on the back, I don't think. I think it really stems more from, I don't know, Dr. Frere, where you were born as much as I do about Dr. Montero, but three guys, at least in our prior conversation, are born on different continents, and you guys have a lot more, international connections than I do, more domestically, but I've spent some time around the world too for business. But really interesting how things come together in the Houston area for groups that think like-minded around limb salvage and wound care. My career didn't start on the clinical side per se, but really for the 20 years that I've been in my professional roles, it has been in the healthcare provider domain and industry. Actually started very early on as a volunteer in a hospital, which was an interesting lens because the departments that I volunteered at weren't the clinical ones to start. It was accounts payable, it was medical record department, and places that you don't think of as a teenager, certainly, and how a business like a hospital works. So you don't think of a hospital as a business, certainly. And you shouldn't just think of it as a business, but that's the seat I'm in today, and kind of comes full circle. But I think for you and I, where we connect, it's about your customer, it's about your patient in this setting, and really in all of business or in all of healthcare. And that gets thrown around a lot, and I think it gets overused in marketing scenarios and settings a great deal, publications. But I've been fortunate throughout my career to really work with clinicians who believe that. And Dr. Shaw will do a much longer and well-deserved intro on himself. But I will say, over the last 16 months since I've taken on this role, I can't be more prouder or more impressed with him and what he has done as the chief medical officer now for going on almost 5 years with R3, but also his background, his focus on education and limb salvage. And that's where you led it, Dr. Montero. So that's where I immediately said, okay, if Shaw could have been here, he should have been here, but we'll have opportunities down the road. And we didn't take much longer to introduce you to him because what I've learned in this, this specific role working in this subspecialty or specialty is Dr. Shah's line, time is tissue. And I've seen firsthand case after case where if you get the patient where they need, if you meet them where they are at the proper time with the proper treatment plan, which doesn't usually start with us, usually it starts with some other chronic condition that has been diagnosed and is being managed by vascular ID, perhaps, in rare cases, maybe your primary care physician. But really, you and your vision, Dr. Montero, of being the quarterback and not just talking the talk, but having been through, you know, corporate medicine, if you will, like I was in corporate business through large big four firms and other consulting companies, actually going about it yourself and taking the leap and saying, hey, I have a vision and I have a way that I believe this should be done. And I'm going to, you know, essentially risk my, not risk, but take the opportunity to, and risk, you won't deny that, financially to start something on my own because I believe in this. And I've been raised in the sense that if you have a strong conviction and belief in something, then you should go do it. But the only way you're going to be successful is if you are committed and you work your butt off to get there. And my parents instilled that in me at a young age, and my family, and you know, the strong friends and culture that I grew up with in Pittsburgh. So I've tried to take that onto this role here. I'm very fortunate and humbled to be in this position. We have 9 clinics. 6 of them are up in DFW, which is where I am right now. 1's in San Antonio, and 2 of them are in Houston. Kind of split the metroplex north and south, but we're looking to grow in all of our geographies. But I will pause there because we'll get a lot more into it. Thanks again for the intro. Really appreciate it. Look forward to this discussion. But without further ado, I think it makes sense for Dr. Shah to give a quick intro. Then let's get to talking on some of the interactive discussion items for today, especially that limb salvage one.
Well, thank you, gentlemen. I think I'm up now. Miguel Lucas, just a pleasure. I would have never thought, looking 20, 30 years back, that I would be sitting here today on a podcast talking about Life of Flow. You know, a lot of like minds, but also different in background. And, you know, our approach and thinking is very unique, but it's just very robust and where we're going with this industry. And I guess to talk forward in our conversation, probably have to know a little bit about my past and how I got here and why we're talking here today is, you know, growing up, I didn't want to be a doctor. Right? It wasn't in my playbook. Because I grew up in the East Coast, and back when space shuttle and launch vehicles were going off, and I said, I want to go in the space industry. I want to go into engineering. And I actually started my career, my education in aerospace engineering, aeronautics. And just to relate a little bit going forward, you know, a lot of engineering has to do with math and physics, but fluid dynamics, for instance. And so a little bit of that kind of integrated in my future. But the industry was very different. It wasn't exciting like it was today in terms of Elon Musk and electric vehicles. And the industry was very, very different. Working, you know, you had to get your PhD, lots of education, you know, no guarantee of what your future is going to be like. And started my first career out of engineering school, actually, in Becton Dickinson, which you may know is all the catheters, syringes, big biomedical company, pharmaceutical company in the world.
BD. We worked exactly with them a lot, yeah.
Yeah, so I was a BD manufacturing development manager and a product design engineer. What do you do there? You talk with doctors, right? Mm-hmm. Say, okay, you know, here's how you do things. Teach me about what you're doing, and here's what I do, and let's find a solution to your problem. And I was a young guy out of school, thought I knew, you know, more than what I know. And they're like, you don't know anything. You're just, you know, young guy out of school. You don't know anything about medicine. What do you know about patients? What do you know about vascular? And sort of a chip on my shoulder. I'm like, I can figure this out. Ain't so bad. I'm going to go to med school. And it's really just out of wanting to know more and learn more. And I like science. I said, if I can use science to help people, there's nothing wrong with that. And see where life leads. Fast forward, medical school, got interested in emergency medicine. And one of the lectures I had in one of our ER roundtable talks was Dr. Bill Ennis. I don't know if the two of you know his name. Probably do. He's probably semi-retired now, but he's one of the sort of the leaders in what we call advanced wound care and education and really disseminating wound programs in hospital-based clinics. He became my mentor and got me very interested in wound care and limb salvage. He was a vascular surgeon turned family practitioner. So he went to vascular surgery, did a fellowship, trained, and then he called it detoxing. And he went back to family practice residency. He said, I need to know how to be a human, connecting with people, but also treat them surgically and tie the two. And limb salvage became a big part of his career. And I got interested from the emergency medicine side of things, saying, wow, this is pretty neat. You know, I see people coming in with diabetic foot ulcers, infections, getting admitted, and then someone in the hospital is taking a leg off, and I don't really know what's happening and how they're doing. And so I realized quickly after residency that this is an industry and field that I want to get involved in somehow. I enjoy patient care. I enjoy procedures. I'm going to try this out. And I took a leap of faith and just jumped in. And back then, as you guys know, physicians weren't heavily involved in wound care as a broad-based practice. It really didn't have a name. There was no specialty. Even today, there's no fellowship in wound care. If you're a vascular surgeon, you do limb salvage, you do carotids, you do aneurysm repair, and all the great things you folks do. And you have other folks doing their things in orthopedics, trauma, cardiology, endocrine, you name it. And so I saw there's a, sort of a beautiful integration that, you know, maybe I can get involved in all of this because I liked a lot of things coming from emergency medicine, like the procedures, but like to also see something come from beginning to end. And you don't see that in many forms of medicine, right? You see something, someone suffering from something, and then you hand it off to somebody else often. In this case, there's a lot of care coordination, but you actually see something in some not so good shape, right? Someone with a terrible wound. And then at the end of the day, they're walking out of your office or they're going back to life, they're going back to work. And I saw this is wonderful. So 20, 25 years ago, I got involved in one of the first outpatient wound centers here in Phoenix, Arizona, and that's where I started my practice and my experience in the field. I really had a wonderful time growing that with a few of my colleagues, partners, and really involved in outpatient wound care in many, many hospitals, involved in leadership and medical directorship, and really scaling that project. In 2011, was lucky enough to exit and merge with a larger company called Team Health, which you may have heard of. They're an emergency services company and nationwide backed by private equity. And I worked, you know, a little bit with them and doing a lot of consulting. And fast forward, and kind of get to the chase here. It was COVID, and I was doing what I was doing, clinical medicine, consulting, and so forth. And Three Rivers Capital found me through a search entity and said, hey, we're looking at R3 Wounded Hyperbarics. They're a Dallas-based company that does outpatient wound care. They're in the community setting, not in the hospital setting. And that's very unique to me because, as you know, much of wound care and limb salvage was really done in the hospital centers and academic centers and the ivory towers. And here's a small sort of clinical setting in the DFW area, San Antonio, that was doing, you know, community-based wound care in people's backyards in the suburbs. So patients had access to wound care and not driving to a big building and going through parking lots and really just conveniently getting access to what they needed for managing their chronic ailments, and particularly wounds. That got me really excited, and I came on board as an operating partner, eventually as a medical director, chief medical officer, as Elliot mentioned. And we brought in Elliot a couple of years ago, and here we are today, really growing a robust outpatient wound care practice, hyperbaric medicine practice in DFW, in San Antonio, Houston, and so on and so forth. And really and excited about what we're offering to patients, but we also know it takes a village to solve this problem. Working with folks like you who do vascular medicine, but also do a lot of what we do, and giving patients an opportunity to get better, give them hope, which is obviously your mantra, and completely excited where this field is going, where the future is going. And as I mentioned, I'm a little bit of a techie too with my engineering background. Elliot didn't expand about his tech sort of enthusiasm. I think, you know, both of you folks are too as well. And I think there's a lot of wonderful things happening, both on the clinical level, on the technology level, like minds bringing things together and kind of imagining what the future looks like. And I'm excited to talk today about all these things and however we go in this conversation. So thank you again.
So when you guys started your conversation, how, Dr. Shaw, on your standpoint, you know, what about the possible collaboration were you excited about? As far as, because obviously you guys have a lot of places where you provide similar services. Obviously Miguel provides different services in the vascular component of it. But what about it gave you excitement that, okay, this is a good collaboration that we should pursue?
Yeah, first and foremost, it's people and passion, right? Yeah, are there better doctors than me? Are there other wound care centers, hyperbaric centers like Arthur? Are you sure there are? Are there other vascular surgeons out there? I'm sure there are. Who is to say one is a better than the other skill set? You know, just to be determined. But really, who's vested in this, right? Who's vested in the future? And, you know, where's the passion? Where's the love? Because it takes a lot of heart, right? You can copy your recipe, but it doesn't taste the same, right?
Yeah.
But when it comes from the heart, and that's what I sense when I talk to Miguel now, you know, with you, is wow, like, this is great. I can see the passion. I can see where you want to go with this. There's also a lot of work we all do on the sidelines that doesn't relate to business and growing and profits and all the things that we talk about on the sidelines. It's really about, you know, we're trying to help people and even help ourselves, you know, our friends and families. We're going to be in this boat one day. We're all getting old, and we need people like us to take care of us. And if we don't establish that foundation for the future, we're in trouble. And that's what excites me, because I see that, you know, behind the scenes when I speak to you folks. There's a lot of collaboration there.
Yeah. One thing that's like super interesting to me, I always like to bring up this. When, let's go back in time, 24 months, when I was already trying to come up with a calculated risk about leaving these positions that I've had with the best salary I could have ever had for a plethora of reasons. But what made sense to me from a proposition, from a value proposition, right? So what are the elements that I think need to become, you know, come together? And I'd like your opinion on this, because here we have this, you know, multi-million dollar business called wound care that has evolved over, you know, years in the American healthcare system. But it has not evolved side by side with vascular care. Okay. And it's almost like they're isolated to the point that the infrastructure is not even there, right? We were discussing that you guys use the same electronic medical record that I elected to use, which is NetHealth. And the reason why was because I see this as kind of like a two thing, right? There's high volume, low margin in wound care. And vascular may be low volume with high margin. And how do you balance those two in two businesses that structurally speaking, that historically speaking, have been miles away from each other? To Dr. Shah's point, vascular care happens in the ivory towers, disconnected horizontally from wherever the patients actually do go for their daily needs. And what needs to happen for those two things to become or to marry? And that was my dream, right? That was where I thought, I was like, I think that's where there's an opportunity.
Yeah.
That was my aha moment, right? Which is, I think that we have a chance of having it. And it doesn't need to be, wound care doesn't need to be parasitically, financially speaking, from vascular. Meaning it's not just that I'm looking for a channel for more patients, right? It's, I need it to be its own cost structure that sustains itself. Well, it's a group practice agreement, right? It's not illegal to, you know, continue referring within the group practice. But it's important for us to give that service. And so you need all those elements combined. But these two groups of businesses have evolved dramatically separately. No EMR, like you have EMRs that are great for vascular, EMRs that are great for wound care. You have codes that are good for wound care. You have codes that are good for vascular. But these things have been far away. And what I think has been happening more so than ever is now with the minimalization of vascular care, with non-invasive techniques, the simplification of a case. I mean, guys, we just did offline our first case cast. So we're going to do a lot of podcasts.
I like that, case cast.
A case cast.
Yeah.
So it was a very complex scenario, and I just fixed it here in the office, and the lady's about to go home.
Yeah.
So the fact that we're now able to do that, in a way, is level setting. Is saying now we're obligated to find a cohesive structure. But that's my perspective, guys. And I'd love Elliot, your perspective from a business. I know that vascular isn't your business, and I'm not expecting you to give me to pontificate on vascular, but it does seem like they've been separate for a long time. And now there's this opportunity of potentially creating some alliances and structure, because that's what these patients need, right? You can't. So what's your thoughts on why they've been so separated?
I'll take this from my personal experiences. Do we have to unite them? I've worked for the largest integrated systems in the world, literally. Partners Healthcare, which is now Mass Jim Brigham, was probably the largest. And we had a team of 70 consultants at a point in time, where we were doing a full-scale sort of financial and operational transformation. And they're not unique to any other, mostly academic medical centers in particular, and a lot of them in the Northeast, but obviously all over the country and the world now. But if you think about the way that businesses grew, these healthcare companies grew, it was by acquisition. And the legacy practices within medicine and healthcare were specialty-based. So when private practices, became established. Texas is a fantastic example because there isn't as much on the academic side, especially in Dallas, as there may be in similar metropolitan areas. It's all really private practices. And I think the mantra was you kind of have your own demand for that specialty, and you stay within your own little world here. And not to sound too, lover of technology, whatever that word is, but like technology, I think has allowed us to realize and reach patients all over from all types of different disciplines that are in the geographies and markets that didn't know about us or we know about them. And I think the fear of maybe competition in a way that you're going to lose a patient, right? We work with a lot of podiatrists, and for very good reasons, because of I think the way that they're discipline has evolved. There's a certain fear that if a podiatrist refers a patient to a wound care practice, then they may never get to manage their care again, right? Because that's work that's going to be done there, and that's just not really a concern that it is valid for us, certainly, but not because we are who we are. I think if you open up your mind, you work with people that have this concept of treating the patient on the whole and understanding what that ecosystem is, like you do, and why Dr. Shaw said we're intrigued to work with you, further to have these kind of discussions, you realize there's enough out there, and patients need us in every different discipline there is. And the technology that exists, whether it's four different EMRs or two or one, what I always say, and what I've really learned as a business person working with clinicians, is that you guys are super smart, but you hate inefficiency. And I do too, actually. I'm a pretty big guy of process, and I always wanted to use technology to alleviate that. And so I view technology not so much as being as automated as possible, but really as streamlined as we can to get people the work they need to do when they need to do it, and let them practice their medicine, their skills of medicine, or whatever it is, billing a claim. But when they have to process and work through a bunch of noise, and that prevents them from doing what they want to do, that's where the problems lie. And people have been very, I think, reluctant or intimidated by technology and the lift and the effort it takes to integrate different technologies so that we can let you guys do what you're going to do, or let these practices do it. So you can do those things in your office now, Dr. Montero, because you figured out a way to integrate the clinical technology and however you got those patients. You learned you don't have to be in a huge academic medical center or a huge network, within Texas Medical Center. Like, you can do it there. But that has taken time. You can lease a bunch of places. The ubiquity of our society and the way it's grown has allowed us to basically lease everything, right? And be able to not have to have that big capital lift, right? Or the big technology lift to have a huge platform to do something. You can do it yourself, but it takes a lot of work. And I probably went on a bunch of tangents there, but trying to pull it together in a way to say that I think that it grew because of fear, because of really, a lack of information, almost ignorance, in the sense that, patients have always been out there. It's up to us to educate them and for certain people to take that leap. and say it's not that scary because there's enough to go around, if you will. There's more than enough people that need our care, right? So let's not be afraid of the multidisciplinary approach, even if it's not one that's fully owned. Let's do it together. You guys have chambers, right? We don't see you as like a competitive threat. Certainly, you know, on paper, it could be because we're in the same market offering the same service. But guess what? You're at capacity. We've got capacity. We treat different conditions under hyperbarics that aren't necessarily related to Vascular, which is kind of what you guys prefer to do, right? And that's another market that Dr. Shaw has got a ton of experience with, you know, delayed radiation effects to the colon, and the rectum, even, you know, the brain for brain cancers, but certainly oral head and neck cancers. That's that month that we're, you know, kind of making awareness this month about in April. You guys don't see those patients, right? And that's a whole other subset of category that, again, on that ecosystem scale, touches every type of oncologist there is, right? Specialty dentistry, et cetera. So a little bit of an elongated response there, but I think that's what it comes down to, really.
I think that's a good response because
can we talk something a little more basic than that?
Let me wrap this particular topic because I'd like Dr. Shaw's opinion on the who do I think is the threat to the evolution of these outpatient models of good care. Is in my opinion, it's hospitals because they don't want to let go of that. Right. They don't, you know, I remember having a conversation with some of the C-suite people in the hospital that said, why would we do outpatient angiograms? I was like, well, because it's the right thing. It's, you know, it's easy access. It's more simplified. It's like, no, we can't bill for the DRG. We can make way more money if we make this a big exuberant thing in the hospital. And so Dr. Shaw, as we're discussing bringing a lot of these almost like centers of excellence should be out of the hospitals. Mm-hmm. But how difficult do you think our battle with the hospitals is going to be? Or do you see other threatening entities to this model? What's your thoughts?
Sure. Lots of answers to those great questions. And I think it's coming from many directions. So let me go a little more historical here. When I was looking at opening one of the first wound programs in a level one trauma center, and I said, well, why do we need to do this? I said, to help with wounds, help with outcomes, help with quality of life, and prevent amputations. And as you know, revascularization procedures have really evolved a lot in 20 years. What you do today is a lot more exotic than what you did 20 years ago. Bypasses 30 years ago were more ubiquitous than interventional. But the answer I got from the C-suite was, well, we make more money from an amputation, and it's quicker, we're done. We don't have to invest in cath labs and hire vascular doctors and surgeons and build a team and then infrastructure and ecosystem. We'll just take the leg off and then we move on. And, well, I hope I don't need to explain why that's a bad idea to our audience and to all of us here. We know why we do what we do. But moving forward now, the hospital systems, yes, you know, they make more money that way. They see us maybe as a threat, but they're in so many other service lines there, in trauma and oncology and in my case, a lot of neurosurgery, which often has to be in a hospital because of the severity and acuity of it. But regulation is probably just as big of a problem. Mm-hmm. You know, when for our industry to grow, you know, we got more and more regulated over 20 years. When I was doing outpatient wound care early on, the debridement codes, the graft codes, the reimbursement for us, the guidelines were a lot looser. We were able to use our judgment more. And everything is so regulated and guidelines are there for protective measures, maybe for society and for patients. And so no one bad apple can abuse it. But I think there's hindrances in regulation allowing us to grow, in legal infrastructure allow us to really deploy everything. And then, of course, you have insurances and health systems that are kind of trying to battle where we really fit in their cost structure model and delivery of care. But I'm hoping that as we do what we're doing, and it's becoming probably more and more obvious to the insurers who really kind of control the gates of where they want their contracts and where they want their patients to go. And I think we can bark all we want, but if we just show through our actions what we're solving, what we're doing, we're already becoming a threat and a force in the industry without even having to fight it. Because we're dealing it man to man, woman to woman with the patients, And they're seeing that and they're coming to us. And then suddenly the volume shift is happening. The care shift is happening. The healing is happening. And almost I'm ignoring the hospitals, frankly. I'm like, do what you want. We're going to continue good care, Mother Teresa style. We're not going to worry what people think or do. We're just going to do good things. And the results will show. And Elliot, for instance, he's done a wonderful job for us because we were back in the Stone Ages with reimbursement for R3. And we were doing today's work at today's cost and yesterday's prices. Mm. And when he started talking to the Blues and the Cignas and the payers, and we're continuing to do that, they realize we are getting reimbursed in the Stone Ages. And hey, we're doing care and work that we deserve better reimbursement for. And hey, by the way, we're going to renege your contracts. What that means is they already see the value we add. So what happens with case management? What happens with the buzz in the industry? Hey, we probably want our patients to go there. They're going to pay less surgical copays, less hospital copays.
We're out of network.
Because the deductibles and copays are higher when the patient goes.
Fantastic point, to the Dr. Sawman. This will be quick. So, yesterday, I had a call with a commercial carrier that we were not in network with on their Medicare Advantage plan. Right, we are for the other ones, and this is a 2-year thing now that's been going on. Finally, as I was on a call last week with them, I had a patient that emailed us and said, "My insurance will not allow us to come to that visit. That means I have to drive 50 miles to go to downtown Dallas to actually have this, hyperbaric study." And it was an Advantage patient. Said, "We'll do it anyway. We'll treat you as an inpatient network, even though you're out of network. That's fine." And I emailed that case to the insurer guy, the insurance representative I've been working with. And he got really emotional and really, took that to heart. And this week he said that he was pounding on the board, on the desk with his executives, and finally they agreed. And it's simply a Medicare case rate. It's the same as Medicare would pay, which they would pay anyway. They have no hyperbaric clinics that are in network with these plans, by the way. Not just not us, right? So my hope is that we can change it for us and, whether you want to call it a competitor or not, for the patients. Because it doesn't make any sense to me. And I think it is regulatory. Dr. Shaw is spot on. Why else would something that is approved by Medicare, for all these cases, not be something that's covered? And it might just be education. It might be time. I don't know. But if we don't actually, make this fight on their behalf and on ours, for our businesses too, and for our patients, it's not going to change. So I'm optimistic. Great point.
Yeah. These are the just very the brilliant points, by the way. This is the kind of stuff that just gets my serotonin going, right? Because I'm here just thinking the big battle hospital, they're the ones that are trying to crush us. And potentially to certain extent,
the hospitals are they're so distracted by the insurance company.
Yeah, they're distracted with all these other shit they do, right? So, but to your point, regulatory, they're draconian regulation. And then here's another one that maybe I'm going to articulate in a different way, which is our inability to relay the benefits of the model to the payer. Because the payers have made it virtually impossible to sit at the table and have a conversation, especially if you're Miguel Montero Baker and see a few lives at risk here or there. I don't make it there. And that's where potentially, even if we, to Elliot's point, even if we were direct competitors for this relatively huge market of Houston, do you understand that power? If there could be 10 of these companies, then now all of a sudden, say 5,000, 10,000 lives at risk, and we go together and we say, listen, look at our numbers, see the amount of reinterventions and readmissions that we're avoiding you. Look at the amount of people that have adherence to medications. Look at the amount of people that I see that are on DAPT, on cholesterol-lowering medications. Like, see at length how much of these patients go by. Like, that's where there's the power of this unity that can come from coalescing industries. Yeah, at the end of the day, maybe competing for certain things, but the bigger message is a huge message. And so I like now expanding when I say what are the threats to building models like this and creating a decentralized certain center of excellence. That's what I keep calling it, right? I always say centers of excellence should not be in a hospital. They should be decentralized. They should be like mani-pedi parlors where you can go and on a daily basis, close to your community, you walk in, no parking fees, you walk in, you get care. The most basic care, you get vascular diagnostics and you can get dives. You can do all these things that they just need recurrently.
Yeah. Two questions, one for Dr. Shah and one for Elliot. Dr. Shah, if there's somebody finishing training right now, say they're in a vascular program, they're not exposed to wound care, say they're just doing aortas all day, but they, so how, because the way I've learned wound care, I feel it's been a lot by like osmosis, in a sense. I don't feel like I have an expertise I can have in vascular care, even though I deal with wound care every day. So how can someone that has had a specialty training in a symbiotic field like vascular care educate themselves and become equally an expert, which they should be, in wound care? And then, so that's one question. Then, Elliot, when you talk to payers, my question to you would be, what incentives motivate them? And what do they want to hear? What do they see as a valid proposition from us? So I'll let Dr. Shah go first and then Elliot.
Yeah, wonderful question. And you know, as you know, in medical school and in residency, there are no formal training programs or modules or lectures for wound and wound management. You probably remember when you were in residency and fellowship, it was put a wet to dry dressing, bandage it up, ABD pads, and
betadine.
And the truth is, you know, I kind of joke, if you have good blood flow, you can spit on a wound and it'll heal. But as you know, because flow matters. I have medical students that train under me too. I'm Professor Creighton. And so I take residents and students, and with students who are wanting to go to psychiatry or something unrelated, how do you get them engaged in what I do? I'm like, look, you're going to forget everything I teach you. Your half-life of your knowledge is 6 years. You're going to forget everything, right? So remember this, if it's dry, get it wet. If it's wet, get it dry. If it's dead, debride it. If there's no flow, get it flow. And it's so synonymous with your podcast, The Life of Flow. There's no flow, get a flow. Because without flow, there is no healing. And so what I'm trying to say is that you have to make it very simple for the masses, even in the medical community, nurses, doctors, residents. But now if you dial into what you're asking, which is surgeons, surgical specialties, vascular surgery, obviously the level of knowledge and interest is a lot higher, greater, and deeper. And what I would say to them is, also detox like my mentor did, which is spend time in a wound clinic, in a multidisciplinary wound clinic. You know, the hospital is a great learning ground for that, and then get out of there, obviously. So what that means is you're working with infectious disease specialists that are managing wounds, podiatry that's managing wounds, nurses that know a lot about dressings and interventions and wraps and vacs and the nuances of what things hurt and help. And then suddenly you know that although you did a surgical procedure and you got the flow there, what does the aftermath look like? You know, you probably know just about, you know, sort of opening the gates. When you have that sudden flow coming in, you have, you know, the free radicals and a lot of tissue damage can occur initially. I have patients that actually have a lot more feeling and pain right after the procedure, and their wounds start draining more because there's a little more flow there. So how do you manage that? What does that look like? What are the inconveniences the patient has? And so you only understand that by doing sort of a lot of just what I call low-level wound care, if you want to call it that, for a surgeon, getting your hands wet, doing the dressings, getting involved in the clinic, and then going back to what you do best. Because what I also feel is, you know, surgeons' passion, the reason they got into the field is they like the OR. They like operating, they like intervening. And so then going back to the OR, I like to keep my surgeons in the OR, frankly, because that's where you're needed the most. There's not enough of you folks doing it there. But at least you understand what people outside the OR are doing as well. And look, I'm not too much into business, but you guys have a 90-day global. So a lot of the work you do postoperatively is just to make sure everything's going okay. That's where you collaborate with a wound program that just is doing post-op management, doing all these other great things that happen in wound care. Go out there. There's many conferences out there that are in wound care as well for the surgeons to learn from. HNP and SAWC, Society of Advanced Wound Care, which I believe both of you attend, and been through DEF CON and all these great, great CME programs. You learn a lot about local wound care. A lot of vendors during the breakout sessions teach about their products. And I love working with vendors. Why? Because instead of me reading a book or a literature or the latest journal article, these folks know about their product more than anybody else because they live and breathe it. And they know all the studies around the product. So whether it's a stent or a graft or a foam or a boot, they know about it. So you can rapidly learn without going reading an article. And you can then decide what's good and bad and integrate that in your practice. So lots of great things, lots of avenues to learn, but just get in there and do it. And I think it's a great way to make a surgeon even better what they do pre and post.
Do you think you can speak to what insurance providers see as a value mm-hmm. proposition? Like if you get a seat at the table, what incentives, like what catchphrases they want to mm-hmm. hear?
Yeah, you know, I think they're very similar in, across any specialty, but readmission rates, right? That's a big one. They don't want people back once they're discharged in 30 days. And if we prove that they're coming to us and they haven't been readmitted for cellulitis, for gangrene, for infection, for pain, for any of those things, I think that's value added. Also utilization of resources. So, you know, are they getting imaging and interventions in the hospital setting versus in the outpatient setting? Is more care being managed at home? Is home health being coordinated? Outcomes and healing. So softwares like NetHealth give you information on healing rates. You know, here's our healing rates. Here's, you know, the discharge rates. These patients are going back to work. These patients are, utilizing the healthcare system, a less burden to the healthcare system because they've come to us. And by the way, here's patient feedback. These are 100 patients that are in your Cigna panel, for instance, that we've treated. And here's their feedback. So there's so many ways to do this. And because they have case managers, I think that's another way to leverage too, if you get seated at the table. Like, what are your case managers seeing? What's the feeling? I think, you know, if you do this communally, it's going to be a great thing to then sit at the table and discuss these things. And look, I think you mentioned an interesting point. If you look at, you know, medicine in general, if you look at the AMA and the AOA, all our subspecialties kind of live a world of their own. They're all about themselves. The unity isn't there. I think the unity needs to occur. If you look at dentistry or chiropractor, fields, their healthcare specialties, they're a lot more united. They have a lot more success in getting what they want. Dentistry, I mean, how many dental insurances are there, right? There's like two major dental insurances in the world, in the planet, and they control everything. Everybody else is self-pay. And so dentists can call their shots and a lot more unified in the approach to managing patients. I think that unity and what Miguel was mentioning, and the seat at the table, and then really driving in those numbers, because we look at metrics and data and readmission rates. And I think all those things combined with what we're offering for price points, right, the co-pays, deductibles, and so forth, are really going to add value. I think Elliot's back on, by the way, with a little technical difficulty.
Right. Yeah. I'm on my cell now. Is that all right?
Yeah, that's perfect. That's okay.
Sorry, guys. Dr. Shaw killed it, though, in that other question. So I was kind of glad that my battery dropped.
It's okay.
I'm back to follow on his response there.
Yeah, he's the sort of the part.
But maybe your Elliot, your two senses on how to drive
insurance
acceptance, adherence, and even, you know, how can we get better contracts from them? Yeah, like.
So I think it's three things. Not all of them are immediately impactable by any of us, right? The main one is you have to be able to get a hold of somebody. Honestly, you know, payers are huge organizations, but they have even larger member networks and provider networks that they work with. So I'm not making any excuses for anyone, but it is a big business and there's always so much to go around. So it takes time, and that can be achieved through either partnerships. You know, there are some consultants and or businesses that focus on network contracting. If you want to do it yourself, you have to be resourceful. That's what it comes down to, period. The second is you have to know how to work within a network of a payer group. So just because panels are full doesn't mean they don't want you to be a part of their plans. It benefits them to have more providers to offer to their members if their costs are the same or similar, right? So how do you get over that? Again, kind of comes down to people and knowing how to negotiate and work within the system, but make it easy for them, all right? If a panel is full, well, that means that somebody has to go through a lot of effort to try to get a new provider, a new contract. If you do all the paperwork and you have all your data and all your information up front, it's easier to move that process along. And then the third thing that I would say is you just have to come with a compelling case. At the end of the day, you're dealing people to people like everything else. And in the example that I provided with that Medicare Advantage member, if you make it real for them, that has a better path to completion than it does, than would a cost savings per se. And again, insurance companies are huge. They already make a ton of money. Their medical cost ratio is pretty well defined, right? Now, COVID threw a loop and that went askew in their favor, so to speak. But it's going to be 30-35%, period. So the costs are important, but it's the cost to the member and the convenience to their member and the fact that their alternative is something that is going to make it a customer service dissatisfaction. And it's all local, right? You have to be able to negotiate. If you're starting, you got to be able to start locally, build your case with, you know, solid data, and then you have to be willing to negotiate too. But that's the last thing. Honestly, if you get all those other things taken care of, the costing becomes, in my experience, it's usually reasonable. They're not trying to pay nothing, right? And we're not trying to, you know, make a fortune either. Everyone wants to do the right thing, but it starts with the business negotiations and terms and deals and doing the right thing for the patient. And then you get to the money.
We have some pretty strong IPAs here in Houston. And specifically for cardiovascular care, there's this IPA, Independent Physician Associations, that was started by Denton Cooley. It's called CVCP. And so you have, I want to say there's like 2,000 like cardiovascular physicians.
Yeah.
And so they have the power and numbers to negotiate some of these deals. Now, the problem with these IPAs is then they become actually really greedy. And so they want like 20% off the 80% that you get. And then you have to collect the 20% of the patient. They don't touch that. But then, of course, not all patients really pay that. So, you know, I'm not necessarily sure how that all works, but I'm curious about the IPA, Dr. Shah, in wound care or hyperbarics. Are there any of these group contracting deals that one can exert in this particular wound care and hyperbaric side of the business, or are they all independent contracts like the ones you currently have with the payers?
Boy, you must be reading my mind, because I always felt that we should have this. No, it does not occur. This is not currently the state of the union. They're all independent contracts, independent entities. People like you and me, individual one-off group, you know, physician groups that have their own contracts that are not in alliance or coalesced to have negotiating power. Our industry is so fragmented for many reasons. One of it is because many specialties are doing it, right? Plastics is involved in wound care, vascular, podiatry, orthopedics, generalist. And so the mindset's a little different. The philosophies are coming from different angles, but it needs to be there. Carolyn Fife, who's a local there in Houston, had that vision as well. I'm more on data, where she wanted to pool all the data of all the wound centers and then present that to CMS about why we do wonderful things. And she did that through her EMR called IntelliCure. And U.S. Wound Registry, I believe, was her approach to driving data. And then data would then prove and justify our existence, and then would drive everything else below it, payments, reimbursement. But to go to your question, I think that needs to occur, maybe in regional markets like we're talking today, whether it's Houston or Texas, and say, we have, you know, 20 wound programs, 50 wound programs, we have 100 clinicians. Here's what we're doing. Here's why it's wonderful. Here's why you don't need to go to the hospital. And then go with Elliot and go at the negotiating table and go with all those, you know, sort of three-legged stool approach and say, here's what's needed in the market. Here's why it's the right thing to do. And by the way, we're a force to contend with, right?
Yeah.
You know, I mean, you have to be a little bit of a bully.
Yeah. I would argue too, I mean, just to kind of play the middleman here. So the ultimate, I think, secret sauce, if you have a contract in particular, though, in offsetting a hospital-based wound care location as a referral source or viable versus outpatient with a payer is the care managers. And not all payers have enough of them. I think the one risk I would say that you get with just amassing a high volume of providers and going to a payer and saying, hey, you guys should cover this, that, or the other thing, is that you are implying that you're back to the fee-for-service model, which is by and large what we experience in our business because it's CPT reimbursement, mostly line item, not global. Some cases can be. But the reason I say that it's a bit of a risk is because the insurance companies, again, are going to manage their medical loss ratio. So as their member networks are going to get bigger, they're going to take on more risk. And as your providers are going to get bigger in your IPA, it's not necessarily going to drive a rate or even their willingness to contract. What I would argue is if you go with a explanation to them on how to get better care to their patient and the opportunity cost on the limb salvage, which I know that story's been told, but probably can be told much more robustly, right, or a more robust manner, you're going to get their attention because that changes the medical loss ratio scale tremendously. If you look at the downstream costs, not just of the care, but the quality of life, right? I mean, you guys taught me this. Like, once you start amputating, it doesn't stop, really, right? Well, so the
life,
more you can prevent
limiting,
it,
right? It's associated with higher mortality, so.
Yeah.
So, and then I would say this, that the whole idea of, you know, you get value with volume, I think that's more applicable in this space on the cost and the supplier side. So, you know, you have very large, general purchasing companies, Cardinal, Vizient, the big, there's 3-4 big ones, right? Like, that's where you get McKesson, right? Like, you can make a volume play there if you get it. Most people are in the GPO already. But they are much more sensitive to that price point because their profits are huge already. So you can get a reimbursement, a lower cost to yourselves. But on the payer side, on the insurance side, that is, I think it's about, you know, really the quality of life, the convenience, customer service, and then also the downstream costs and the offset, the opportunity costs. So maybe we tell that story a little more effectively.
Would you think that the margins are still there for this to be a defensible market?
You mean outpatient wound care?
Yes, sir.
Absolutely. Yeah.
It's interesting. I'll say that. I'll tell you why I was trying to tickle you with that, because I had a meeting with a PE group not too long ago, and they were essentially laughing. And I felt a little bit self-conscious because I'm there having a conversation about how, you know, these codes, they're compressing us, and now, you know, we can't, you know, how do you pay all this? And we have all these overheads. And, you know, one of the guys kind of said, like, have you ever calculated your margins? And I was like, no. Well, he's like, no, but like, do you understand that we see like interest in margins when there's like 1 or 2%? Like, you can generate a lot of money on a very low margin when you know what you're doing and you know how to make it work. Medicine has retarded margins. The problem is that you guys have not known how to run businesses appropriately. And so there seems to be, and that's, I think that it's inevitable. I think everybody's seen it. There's an influx of private equity into healthcare in many, many regions. Because there's a highly profitable market, it just needs to be run well. It needs to have metrics. It needs to have improved. I just think the capacity is there as long as we're true to the clinical message. And that's the thing, because, you know, also here's the steel manning of that. I've got doctors that have been in OBLs for years. And when I say I went to the OBL, they're like, you're crazy. Everybody's leaving the market. You shouldn't be going from that. Like, that's stupid. You should be actually staying in your cush position in the hospital. I think that you're not going to be successful. And then I talked to this other group of people and they're like, you're what? No, it's highly successful. The margins are there. You just need to know what you're doing. And I think that what we have is the clash between a model that was retardedly lucrative at some point, that's not like that, but that really mishaps in the administrative side still were okay. And now we're in a place where the margins are good, but you just have to know how to run your business. Yeah. And you know, maybe close it, you know, closing up a little bit of that conversation.
How do you balance that how do you manage the bandwidth of doing both highly complex clinical cases, which is requires a lot of your mental energy and time, and then the efficiency of the practice, because you're ultimately responsible for both. And I could see how
that question for me.
Yeah, that's a question for you. I feel like that could be a daunting task.
Yeah, I mean, I'm telling you that it was made clearer than ever by this one meeting I had, that I had a potentially very successful thing on my hands, and that I just had to be very good at it, or be smart like Dr. Shah and have people like Elliot, right? And I think that in that, we need to be very clear that you need a very strong financial and administrative component in your practice. The days in which doctors...
But you are not the driver of that. Or are you?
Well, here's the thing.
He is.
Here's the thing. I don't think doctors should be dumb enough to let this discourse that we're not smart enough to look at a spreadsheet and be able to balance it out. And this is what the C-suite has told us, believe that we can't do it.
The day-to-day, like, attention to detail to everything. I feel like that would be very difficult.
You have to create a team. Have to create...
Yeah.
Dr. Shah, I see you nodding. Your thoughts on how do we balance a healthy relationship with understanding that, yes, we're here for a mission, but it's a business. And that business apparently could be still lucrative and successful when the right pieces and components are in. What's your thought of what are those components and how do you do it?
Yeah, I'm going to take a line from Elliot and Joe, our president's playbook, which is no money, no mission.
So, no margin, no mission.
And no margin, no mission. Sorry, that's
I love
margin,
that.
Money, same thing.
That's going to be viral, by the way. No margin, no business. I like that.
We all go into medical school going to help people, and no one talks about business and finance in medical school. I actually pull aside my resident students and tell them, first 2 weeks is business finance, last 2 weeks is clinical, because you have to think that way. Even a nonprofit, you have to think that way because your resources are limited.
True.
And if you don't know something, you bring in help. If I don't know about endocrine or neurology, I call a consultant, right? I get a consult, I get a second opinion. So if you need a second opinion in your business, get it. If you want to go into business and you're not in one now like you did and you transferred over, get the resources to learn about it. But yeah, for sure. I know enough to get myself in trouble sometimes. Elliot comes from a very consulting, heavy load kind of background, multiple health systems, as he mentioned. I learn a lot from him, learning by osmosis. You know, I didn't know what a KPI was 10 years. I didn't know what that meant. I didn't know what it stood for. And now it's an everyday language, you know, key performance indicators. How do you manage people, employees, performance metrics, HR, accounting, finance, reimbursement, RCM? We're not taught RCM, but all our practices revolve around revenue collections, right? And I didn't learn anything about RCM in training. I don't know if you folks did either.
Nope.
You learn by getting beat up, by making mistakes, by maybe being fortunate to have people like Elliot on your side. And that's what happens. The business folks come in and say, you don't know anything. We're not going to tell you anything. We know more than you do. And by the way, we can take over your business and run it for you. You just see patients, right? Stick in your hole. I think we're all smart people. We just have to have an interest and a little bit of humbleness to say we need help and learn in parallel and grow, because we're all learners. And then use that to really drive good healthcare with good financial metrics, with people that are part of your team, and you help each other, and beautiful things happen. I can say just in the last 2 years, year and a half that I work with Elliot, but 2 years just with a full management team, it's a beautiful thing to integrate that whole business side of things, because you're able to drive more care, see more patients. And ultimately, like you said, you're like a one-man person, but suddenly you're not just helping one patient at a time. You're helping, you want to help people, you want to scale. Right? Not just one at a time, but thousands at a time. Well, how do you do thousands at a time? How do you have podcasts like this? We're educating in the millions today, right? I'm hoping you have a lot of viewers, because we're teaching everyone around us how to do what we're doing, learn from our mistakes, share our knowledge, and do wonderful things at scale. And its scalability is an important thing, and I want people to think of it that way. Part of it is finance and operations and management. But you don't want to think one patient at a time. You want to think hundreds at a time, thousands at a time, right?
Yeah.
I love that.
I would maybe add in a final thought here, you know, you guys are experts in a very important field. You're saving lives, literally limbs, lives. That's not even being superfluous, right? But what do you guys do best? Why? What are you going to do no matter what happens when a patient comes in? The goal is to treat their ailment, illness, and make them healthy. You know your outcome as a clinician the second you wake up every morning, right? It's to fix the patients in front of you. All right. So how are you going to do that? And why are you going to do that? And what approach are you going to take? You're going to do it whatever way you need to. You're going to be resourceful. Use all the training that you had. You're doing it for the right reasons for the patients. And what drives you? Doing it at scale. But at a certain point, it's the efficiency. What do you want to do? You want to do more of it, like Dr. Shaw said. And you want to hone your skills. You can only do that with efficiency. And you only get efficiency as you learn more and you delegate and you have people that are working in concert with one another, right? So you know your end goal and you keep that in mind. And as a business person, if we have that shared end goal and we're helping one another get there, that's how we transform the business. So the reason, Dr. Montero, that you can balance those things, I believe, even though you're not, you know, as a well-trained business person or the experience that I have, is because you're resourceful. Right? How do you answer the question? I mean, I don't know the answer. How do you do the procedures in your office that you used to pay, you know, essentially a hospital to do, or used to rely on a hospital to do? Probably because the machines are cheaper, you know, more available, more leasable. You learned from somebody else and you listened and you figured out a business model that would make it work. Now, that's not sustainable when you want to open up the new Hope Center somewhere else. You have to find a way to build that into a model, and you will, right? And that's what we're doing too. And that's what I'm trying to help with R3. And that's where Dr. Shaw and I have had a very good synergy. And I think, you know, literally there is no finality to this. It's simply, how do we keep doing it better? And I think together with like minds, we can really make a big difference.
Gentlemen, yeah. I would just want to say thank you. I know we started a little bit late because we had a case, but this has been fun.
This has been a really nuanced, really great conversation.
It's fun. Yeah. I told you, I know that Lucas was going to enjoy listening to you guys, and I certainly look forward to having many more of these conversations on and off the pod.
For sure.
Does that sound like a plan?
Absolutely, guys. Sorry about the AV difficulties. Shaw got me covered, though, as always. So.
It's okay.
For the tech guy, you had a lot of difficulty.
I know, right? I think myself look bad. Do as I say, not as I do.
All right, guys. Well, I hope to also cross your paths in person, Dr. Shaw, very soon, and we'll be in touch.
Planning coming out to Houston, so I'll let you know when I do.
That's awesome. Guys, have a great afternoon.
Care. Yeah, don't hang up yet. We're going to... We'll
talk offline.
I'll talk offline.
All right. Thanks, to everybody guys. Out there, right, yeah. Thanks for seeing and hearing. Bye. Pura vida. Bye.
Two vascular surgeons walk into a bar and come out with a podcast. We are talking everything vascular and not. Welcome to the Life of Flow podcast.